Well, I'm going to have a harder time passing myself off as Bob Kramer, but I'm going to do my best. This presentation today is about cover crops and soil health in Missouri, and most of this is about some of the research that he's been involved in over the last few decades. So we know that integrating cover crops in a diversified management system is one of the better ways of protecting our soil resources and maintaining or improving soil function and soil health. And this picture is from 1997. It's from the Bradford Farm. And even though cover crops have become increasingly popular recently, it's not anything new. And some people, including Tim Reinbod and others, have been looking at these things for a long time. And in this picture, I can see some brassicas and some grasses and a variety of other things. So cover crops can be especially important in degraded or marginal landscapes, and we have a lot of that in Missouri. We have what's called the clay pan. Excuse me. And the clay pan is a subsoil layer that is about 40 to 60% clay, and it impedes water infiltration. And this can cause a lot of problems with growing crops. So we need to integrate some conservation practices, and we need to limit off-site movement of inputs such as herbicides, pesticides, and fertilizers, including soil. So this picture is from some highly erodible soil in the Missouri River uplands in Howard County, Missouri, and you can see that erosion there has been quite a problem. Here's another picture from an alluvial landscape in Missouri where we have intensive crop production occurring right on a river, and this is a situation where including a riparian buffer strip with maybe some grasses or even trees would have been really helpful to reduce some of the loss of soil into the river. In the Ozark foothills, we also have vulnerable landscapes with steep slopes, and this is another example of an area that would benefit from cover crops if you establish them during or after harvest. And a lot of these slopes at one time were in pasture, maybe in CRP, and they're being converted back into annual row cropping. So in this case, if you want to help preserve the soil quality, and keep it from eroding, you want to consider using cover crops. So the term soil health has been used a lot, probably at this conference in general. But you also have the term soil quality, and even though they may often be used interchangeably, they do have slightly different conceptual definitions. So soil quality, usually we're thinking about how well the soil is functioning, maybe at a certain threshold or capacity, and we're often thinking about things like crop productivity or yield. And when we talk about soil quality, maybe we're thinking more about some of the nutrient, the chemical and physical properties of soil. Soil health is a broader concept, and I like to think of it as sort of expanding soil quality and including the biological component of soil and thinking of soil as a vital living system that is supporting air quality, water quality, and promoting plant health, animal health, and human health. So we know that there's a strong relationship between the plants in the system as well as the soil microbes. And Dr. Nichols did a great job of talking about that earlier. But the plants in the system are providing carbon and nutrients to the soil microbes. And we have a lot of microbial biodiversity. And a lot of people don't think about what we have in the soil below ground. We have bacteria, we have algae, we have fungi and nematodes. And the below ground biodiversity is also very important. Above ground in a native grassland system, you might have upwards of 200 different native grass and forb species. And below ground, in the soil microbes, you can have over a billion microbes in one teaspoon of soil. And all those microbes are performing different functions. They're interacting with each other. They're interacting with the plants. They're communicating back and forth. They're involved in pesticide resistance and a lot of other important things like producing growth hormones for plants. So So again, biodiversity is this complex concept that we need to start thinking of in terms of what's happening below ground, not just what's happening above ground. And this is an image that shows we have earthworms, we have arthropods, we have, in addition to the fungi and the bacteria. So when we think about soil health, there are a lot of different things that we can measure, and we call those indicators. We have physical soil properties that most of us are probably familiar with, aggregation, water retention, bulk density, things like that. We have the standard chemical or nutrient analyses that we measure. So we think of phosphorus, potassium, things like that, pH, electrical conductivity. And then the biological component is something that's been ignored for a long time, but we need to measure things like the microbial biomass and what's going on in the soil. So we have a lot of biological measurements that we can include. And so organic matter is considered a keystone soil health indicator because it sort of is at the intersection of those physical, chemical, and biological components because it has an impact on all of these other soil health indicators. So here's a picture of the root systems of a lot of different grasses below ground, and the ones that Dr. Kramer has labeled are some of the warm season grasses that are native to Missouri. But these extensive root systems are providing those organic substances that are driving those below ground microbial processes. And that's called rhizodeposition, and this is carbon that's fixed via photosynthesis, and then it's released through the soil, through the roots into the soil. And if you notice on the far left, there's Kentucky bluegrass, which is a very shallow root system. And so you can imagine that its impact on the soil microbial community is concentrated just in that area. Whereas these warm season grasses that are very deeply rooting are able to drive those processes deep in the soil. And we know that the soil microbes like to live on the soil organic matter. So they find images. You can see the soil bacteria is colonizing that particulate organic matter. Sometimes you can consider that the active carbon fraction. And again, we're talking about the organic matter that is recently deposited, it's partially broken down, and it's still very nutritious, if you will. And the microbes are very attracted to that. It drives a lot of their metabolism. But microbes are not spread evenly throughout the soil. So you want to think about microbiogeography. Not all microbes are everywhere. So they're usually concentrated in the rhizosphere around the roots, and they're also concentrated in the surface soils where the organic matter is actively being deposited. So how do we measure soil health? Well, first you want to think about what are the critical soil functions that you're interested in. Why does soil matter? Well, soil performs a lot of functions, including productivity in the top line. Obviously, crop productivity is important. It regulates and partitions water and solute flow, so you can think about that as water infiltration. It can filter, buffer, degrade, and otherwise interact with organic and inorganic material that includes things like pesticides, herbicides, other pollutants. It's also involved in storing and cycling nutrients in the biosphere. And one that we often don't think about too much is habitat for things like quail and other animals. But these functions are all critical for the soil processes that are biological, chemical, and physical. And then we have to choose indicators that we're going to measure that are going to reflect changes in this process or the soil function. So you need to pick things that are sensitive to these changes. So there are a lot of different things that we can measure. And this is not a comprehensive list, but it covers a lot of the things that you'll see in the literature and different studies. But again, we're looking at physical, chemical, and biological components of soil health. So on your left are some of the more common physical measurements. The ones that I have in red are the ones that we use in our lab a lot The ones that we work with something called the SMAP, which is the Soil Health Index. So we have bulk density, aggregate stability, water holding capacity. Then on the right side, we have some of the more common chemical indicators. Soil organic matter, he chose to put that over there. It can really fall into some of, well, I guess we often put that in the biological category, but again, it sort of covers everything. But we also have soil pH, electrical conductivity, and the nutrients, phosphorus, and potassium. And then on the bottom are these biological soil quality indicators that include microbial biomass. And again, that's sort of telling you, okay, what is the amount of the microbial population? And then we have soil enzyme activity, such as glucosidase, and that's kind of telling you what those organisms are doing. So the difference between who's there and what they're doing and what their activity is. And then potentially mineralizable nitrogen is another important one that is different from total nitrogen. It's the nitrogen that's been immobilized. So these are some examples of some work that Dr. Kramer has been involved in. This picture is from Bradford Farm, and I think this might be one of Tim's eight-way mixes. Is that? It looks like I see sunflower in there, some looks like millet and some grasses and a variety of other things. But again, by using an eight-way mix, maybe you're not achieving that native diversity of 200 above-ground plant species, but you're really starting to expand on the plant biodiversity. This is on the clay pan soils of Missouri, where they planted forage radish on a Mexico silt loam, so Audrain County, Missouri. And this is a project that Dr. Kramer has in conjunction with Rich Horman. And they started this, well, at least back in 2009, but this is an ongoing project, this is a long-term project, and they plan on evaluating, again, measuring all of these different indicators of soil quality and monitoring these changes over time. This is a fairly new study site. It's the NRCS Soil Health Demonstration Farm in Sheraton County, Missouri. And in this picture, they have corn that was no-tilled into cereal rye and herring vetch mulch in 2014. And in this case, I understand that they sprayed it a week or two before they planted the corn. But this is a new project, and again, they're going to monitor this over the long term and see what improvements they can detect, because this was a really degraded farm before they started this project. Here's some more row crop production systems. On the left, there was corn, was no-tilled into rolled cereal rye. And this is a roller crimper, and Tim can probably elaborate on that at some point if you have questions about how successful rolling that was. And on the right, there's a picture of a grass waterway that, instead of just having fescue, which is what you usually see in a grass waterway, we have a lot of native grasses and forbs, and that's providing habitat for quail and pollinators, and also, again, just improving our biodiversity. So these are the results of a study. This was samples that were collected back in 2008 from about 15 different management systems in the clay pan region of Missouri. And we had, see, Dr. Bob has changed all the labels here, but I can tell you that on the left are all the perennial systems. So the high-functioning soils were ones that were either in CRP or some kind of working grassland like a hay system or a forage pasture. And on the right, on the lower soil quality scores all came from annual cropping systems. And within those annual cropping systems, we found that no-till performed better than the mulch-till, and the conventionally tilled site was the lowest. But within those systems, if you diversify your management and include cover crops, you find that you can boost that soil health score even higher. And at least within the systems that we looked at, the one that he circled here, the corn, soy, wheat, and clover, that soil health score is equal to some of the CRP plots that we also looked at in this study. So that's pretty good. In this study, they used oats as a cover crop for managing annual beans. They looked at aggregate stability, which is in the upper left. The red bars are where they had the oat cover crop, and the blue bars are where they did not, just the weed control. So obviously we see huge improvements in aggregate stability. In the bottom right, we have soil microbial activity. In this case, it was dehydrogenase. And the oat cover crop also improved the microbial activity. Then they looked at root density. So if you look at the root biomass from the oat versus the henbit, which is the weed in this case, the oats have much higher root biomass than the henbit. So again, you're probably in improving soil health in and of itself because you're increasing the amount of root exudates and supporting that microbial community. But henbit is also it also harbors the soybean cyst nematode, so it's something that we would prefer to suppress. And in this case, they found that on the far right, where they had oats, they really suppressed the henbit root biomass. So if that's successful, then again, there's a potential even for less herbicide use, which is an additional benefit. This is Prairie Birthday Farms in Clay County, Missouri, which is near Kansas City. And this is an orchard system where they have established perennials in the alleys between between the trees. And in most orchards, they will, if anything, plant a grass or maybe something like fescue and mow it. And then they'll often spray along the tree line to eliminate any potential competition or perceived competition. And here's an example of where they have native grasses and forbs, and they just let them grow throughout the entire orchard. And this is what they found in soil organic matter within that particular system. So back in 2000, when they started this, they had about 2% organic matter, and I put a little conversion thing down here in the corner for those of you who think in terms of SOC. It's about 1.2% organic carbon. And so over the 14 years, they've increased the organic matter from 2% to 6%. That's 4%. Yes? Oh, sorry. Here's another agroforestry system where they use currant clover. And this is not a real common cover crop. It was native to Russia and it was brought over. It's used more commonly up north in, I think, Wisconsin and Minnesota area. But it was planted around this pecan system. And what they found in measuring organic carbon and organic matter, that the stands with the clover had higher organic matter. Where they only had fescue, it was lower. And then the reference to the annual cropping system nearby, which I believe was wheat, had pretty stable and pretty low organic matter content. This is a picture of their solar corridor. This is again out at Bradford Farm. And they're intercropping cowpeas and using wide solar corridors, which allow the corn to intercept more solar radiation. And I think there'll be a specific, Tim will be giving a talk on that tomorrow if you want to know more about that particular study. So they measured glucosidase activity as well as active carbon, and they found that the systems with the solar corridor had increased levels of both, and the monoculture corn was down in the bottom. And the stuff in the middle is probably reflects some of the different corn hybrids. I think they had up to 10 different hybrids that they planted. And economics is something that comes up a lot when you're trying to convince people to use cover crops or any type of conservation management practice. And I'm not an economist. But a group of people led by Lauren Cartwright in Missouri and Brian Kerwin in Illinois have developed this economic decision tool. And it's an Excel spreadsheet. It's available online. You can download it. And the way it works is by calculating a partial budget. And so you enter in all the different factors in your management system, including everything from your labor to maintenance on your equipment, and you can try to predict if and when you will have a profit, and it will give you either short-term output or long-term output. So I highly recommend that those of you who are interested in cover crops look at this. It's a work in progress, and they're open to suggestions. So if you see something in there that's missing or that you think might be incorrect, be sure to let them know. So in summary, cover crops can enhance microbial activity in organic matter and improve soil health, and that's really important to maintaining crop productivity and the environment. The quote from Duran that he put in here is, soil health is considered the major linkage between conservation management practices and achievement of major goals of sustainable agriculture. So what that's really saying is that we have these strategies, we have these management practices, and soil health and measuring soil health and quantifying it is the link between putting the practice in place and obtaining that goal of sustainable production. And we need to be able to quantify that and make sure that we understand where we're headed. So, all right, well, thank you for bearing with me since this was, I'm just pinch hitting for Dr. Kramer here. So I'll take questions. I'm not sure if I'll be able to answer them.
We have a question came in from the live stream. Can you comment on the potential economics associated with growing native grasses and forbs in an orchard, in the alleys and orchards? And so the question is related particularly to the yield of the, for instance, the pecans and the quality, the crop quality.
Right. Well, so the study that I showed earlier, I don't think they were measuring yield on those orchard trees. So this is a small farmer, and she does all the work pretty much herself. And so in this case, I can't give you any data related to that. And it's not something that I've personally studied. So I guess I don't have an answer to that question, but it's a good one.
No, but just a minute. Any other questions? Chris and I have one.
Okay.
I noticed on your slide of your data, mm-hmm. it showed the soil health index.
Yes.
And the grass was the highest,
mm-hmm.
higher than prairie.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that the same thing, some of the same data that we've collected too, that
yeah.
are continuous grass actually is better than prairies. Why is that?
Well, this may vary depending on where you are, but the one thing I can say about the prairie systems that we've studied in Missouri is that a lot of the warm season grasses don't have as dense of a stand as some of the cool season grasses. And even though they're deeply rooting and they're native, we do see more bare soil. So I'm not sure if you're perhaps getting more erosion, more soil loss in some of the native systems. But when you're calculating the soil quality index, the SMAF, again, one of the caveats of using that is it was designed really for agricultural production systems, not for native ecosystems. So you have to, one area where, for example, Tucker Prairie, one of our native prairies, it takes a hit on pH because it has a naturally very low pH, which does not look good in terms of agricultural productivity. So for pH, it's not going to score as well. And one of the things that I'm interested in doing moving forward is expanding on the scoring system that we use for native ecosystems, and that would be forest ecosystems as well as prairies. But right now, what we have are algorithms that were designed to sort of optimize crop productivity. So that's a limitation of that. But I can say that in looking at our data, systems that have a mix of cool season and warm season grasses do tend to do better. And I would think that, again, it's because you have a denser stand, and that may just be due to the specific species that we have in our area. So.
We have
some questions. Can I have a question? One of the things that we're facing in Missouri is the problem Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if there's any index of soil resilience that perhaps cover crops might improve to deal with some of these greater extreme events that we're seeing, higher rainfall, drought. Is it possible that cover crops are increasing soil resilience so that recovery possibly from some of these extreme events that we're seeing?
Well, I would think that absolutely that would be the case, because if you have a robust microbial system that's able to supply plant nutrients and things like potassium and phosphorus and other nutrients that are critical for drought stress, that again you're gonna have a more resilient system. Anytime you have increased biodiversity, we see in general that the system can buffer changes in climate more easily. So I would say, without having any data to support that, I would say absolutely.
I think there was evidence in that cover crop survey that SARE did following the 2012 drought. They had, seven states, most of them very heavily hit by drought. And when corn followed cover crops, they had about 11% yield decrease in those states. And the soybean followed cover crops, they had about 14% increase. And again, that's a survey done by SARE and with the CTSC, the Concentration Technology Information Center. So I think that evidence is out there.
Anything else?
Just a comment. One of the things in the Western Great Plains pertaining to the native prairies, and it's related to management. Mm-hmm. The health of the native prairie was always better if it was grazed and with occasional fire. So do you know about those native prairies that you're talking about?
Yes. Related
to the health that Tim was asking?
Yeah, I do. So we had two native prairies in that study. One of them was grazed prior to probably 1950 when it was taken over by the university. And then they stopped the grazing. But they do periodic burns every 2 to 5 years, and they rotate that around. The other prairie was a restored prairie. So it was previously cropped pretty intensively, and then had been in a restoration phase for about 14 years. And they burned that, but not on any sort of regular basis. When I talked to the manager, he said whenever the trees start appearing, he just goes out and burns. So, but yeah, those are important factors. And within the other systems that we studied, we did see a boost in soil health scores if grazing was involved, because again, you're sort of recycling those nutrients. So, thank you.
I will thank you, Kristen. Let's give her a hand. And we will have a 15-minute break and resume with Tom Casper. I'm going to leave you with one thing. My mother-in-law had the same garden for 50 years, same spot. They plowed up a mixed pasture, and she once told me my best garden was my first garden. I wonder why.